This episode is brought to you by Escape Makers' first-of-its-kind virtual agritourism conference. For more information, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
Meat and Three is back. We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. A California jury recently ordered the company Monsanto to pay just over $2 billion in punitive and compensatory damages to a married couple who both developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which they say was caused by their many years of using the product Roundup, a popular weed killer containing glyphosate. Given this recent verdict, in addition to other recent lawsuits with similar outcomes, I thought it was time to learn a little bit more about the herbicide, including how it came to be so pervasive and what its prevalence means for human environmental health around the world. Joining me on the show today to discuss is a woman who literally wrote the book on glyphosate, Carrie Gillum. Carrie is an investigative journalist and author of Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So what made you want to write this book? what made you want to dive deep into the dark world of glyphosate?
Well, I have to say, I've been deeply into the dark world of glyphosate and Monsanto for, you know, many, many years, almost 20 years before I started writing the book. As a journalist for Reuters International News Agency, that was my beat, food, farming, agriculture. And a big part of it was covering Monsanto and was spending a lot of time at their headquarters and with farmers in the fields, you know, learning about this genetically engineered seeds and the pesticides that were used, Roundup specifically, with these new seeds. And, you know, so I started writing about the company in 1998 and followed the science and the evolution of both the environmental impacts and the human health impacts that we were seeing in the scientific literature. So in 2015, this, you know, publisher called me up and said, hey, you're writing all these really interesting things. Would you write a book? And I initially said no, because who would read a book about all of these pesticide
me.
Concerns? You know, so I then did become convinced and left Reuters and wrote the book, started writing the book in 2016. And I'm quite glad I did now, of course, because I've become quite passionate about it. And I do feel like this information is important to, you know, consumers probably more than anybody else, because this is, you know, doing such a great deal of damage to our environmental health and our food supply and, you know, the science shows us it's dangerous for our own health. So I'm glad I wrote it now, but I certainly wasn't driven to it.
No, let's just like kind of start at the beginning. Just very simply, what is glyphosate?
Glyphosate is a chemical. It's a molecule that has actually been around for many, many years, but companies were having a hard time trying to figure out what to do with it. They couldn't find anything useful, any useful properties, until Monsanto's scientists discovered the herbicidal properties, the weed-killing properties that came with this chemicals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was going to be a blockbuster because it's non-selective, meaning it'll kill most anything you spray it on in terms of plant life. And it has a very specific mode of action. So it works through sort of an enzymatic pathway that is seen in plants, but not seen, according to the science at that time, and according to Monsanto, not seen in people or animals. So the idea was it would be really effective and really kill weeds and plants and things that you wanted dead. It would do it really quickly. But it wouldn't be harmful to people or to animals. That was, the idea behind it all. And when Monsanto rolled it out in 1974, it developed all of these different formulations, which glyphosate was the main ingredient. And there were other ingredients, of course, but glyphosate was the active ingredient. And so Monsanto brought to market Roundup. Most people know that name.
Right.
But there are many, many other brands. And it is off patent now, and so there are generics, glyphosate generic herbicides sold all around the world too.
Wasn't it? Didn't they say it was? What is it? Safe enough to drink when it was first? First came out. Not that I don't know how many takers there were on that one, but I mean, it did seem like they were. This was very pushed as very, very safe in the beginning.
Very, very safe. Right. I mean, very effective and very safe. And yes, safe enough to drink, safer than table salt. I mean, these were the things that sold this in the minds of the public, as well as farmers and cities and counties and golf course operators and forestry management all around the world. This has become, you know, the go-to herbicide. And it is now indeed considered the world's most widely used herbicide. And it is very true that compared to some others that were being used by farmers, like paraquat, for instance, those paraquat and some other herbicides can be quite deadly in a very acute basis. Paraquat, you get a little bit in your mouth, you splash a little bit up and accidentally swallow a little bit, and you're going to be dead in a couple of weeks.
Wow.
So glyphosate, you know, comparatively, was safer.
Yeah.
But what the science has shown us, of course, is that the long-term exposure, and particularly the exposure because people have been told it's so safe, they haven't been taking precautions. They don't wear protective gear. You know, if you spray it around in your yard, you see advertisements. Monsanto shows people in shorts and flip-flops and T-shirts spraying it. But the science has shown that that's a really bad idea.
So it was first introduced for non-crop uses, right? And then that has changed over time?
Well, I mean, it was pretty quickly adapted for agricultural use in the 70s. It became widespread in the 70s and 80s. But in agriculture, the use exploded in the 90s when Monsanto introduced Roundup Ready crops, because prior to the Roundup Ready crops, farmers could only use it, you know, much in the same way they used others. They could use it to prepare their fields, for planting. They could use it, you know, perhaps along edges and things, but they couldn't spray it right over a field of soybeans, for instance, because the soybeans would die.
Right.
Along with the weeds.
Yeah.
But when Monsanto introduced these genetically engineered crops in the 90s, they were designed to tolerate it, to resist the glyphosate. And it was like a magic bullet. You know, farmers just thought, oh, my Lord, this is the best thing ever. I can spray it over my entire field. And the weeds that are in there sucking up, you know, moisture and nutrients will die, and my crops won't. And so, you know, they loved it. And Monsanto rolled out Roundup Ready corn, Roundup Ready soybeans, and Roundup Ready canola, and cotton, and alfalfa, sugar beets. It became the hottest thing in agriculture. Now, Monsanto wasn't doing this out of, you know, oh, we really want to help farmers.
Right.
And as I looked in my book, their patent was expiring on glyphosate, and they were looking for a way to continue to capture that market and to expand their share. And so they sold out these crops. And, you know, that's one of the things we talk about in the book. You hear all about genetically engineered crops are all about feeding the world. And really in their origin, and still to this day, they're more about selling herbicide than they are about feeding the world. They don't have anything to do with yield or improved nutritional quality or anything like that. Roundup Ready crops are all about selling glyphosate-based herbicides, and it worked great for Monsanto. We had volume use of glyphosate herbicides was around 40 million pounds a year in the United States before they introduced these crops, and it's up to about 300 million pounds a year now in the United States.
Wow. I don't even know how to conceptualize that. Like, I have no kind of basis of comparison. It just, I mean, it seems like a lot, but and it's the most, you know, you widely used, you said, but like, is there anything that's second? Like, you know, how do I kind of wrap my head around these numbers?
It is the most widely used in vast quantities. And that is because you typically cannot spray a pesticide directly onto a plant and not harm the plant, particularly a weed killer. So you don't have a lot of other options. Now, Monsanto has introduced some new genetically engineered crops that can also be sprayed with dicamba and also be sprayed with 2,4-D. So those older weed-killing chemicals are making a comeback as well, and we're seeing more use of those.
And is that because of the rise of sort of what they call super weeds? Like there have been some of these crops have kind of, or the weeds have become resistant eventually over time to glyphosate?
Yeah. One of the interesting things that I found was that weed scientists warned the EPA in the 90s when Monsanto was rolling out these crops. They told our Environmental Protection Agency and Monsanto, this is a really bad idea, because what's going to happen when you're using it at these higher levels and you're spraying it more often and putting it directly onto, you know, these wide areas, weeds are going to become resistant. A big part of agriculture is the successful agricultural practices of traditionally have been more about sort of mixing it up and rotating crops and using cover crops and using other techniques that keep the soil rich with a variety of nutrients that are all sort of needed in an interactive way. Mm-hmm. And what this Roundup Ready cropping system did was encourage farmers to just throw that handbook out the window and just start planting Roundup Ready corn, Roundup Ready soy, put the same herbicide on it year after year after year after year. No cover crops needed, no rotation needed.
So in a sense, it was like easier for the farmer.
It was much easier, and in the short term, you know, they loved it. But as you said, we did then immediately start to see the rise of weed resistance. And it became a big problem in the mid-2000s with only 10 years in. About 2010 or 11, it was a crisis in farm country. And now it really is. We have over 100 million acres in the U.S. of farmland that has resistant weeds on it that farmers can't kill. They can get some of them as big as a small tree or a man.
Wow.
I mean, it's been a real problem. And what we talk about in the book is a pesticide treadmill. And so the chemical industry has said, don't worry about changing up your practices. Just let's pour more pesticides onto the problem.
Right. How was it decided to use to create these seeds specifically for these types of crops? I mean, they all seem mostly like commodity crops. So what was the sort of decision point around that, and why haven't we seen it spread as much to other, you know, like specialty crops?
Well, our largest production of crops is corn and soybeans and wheat,
before the Roundup Ready seeds.
Yes, and today. I mean, those are, you know, our main crops that we use in ingredients for food for people, ingredients for food for pets and livestock. You know, corn is in pretty much everything probably in your refrigerator and your cabinet. They did try to, you know, and this, I write about this, they tried very hard to get a Roundup Ready wheat.
I know. I was going to ask you about that. I read that and I was like, why was that the one crop where people were like, I draw the line?
Well, because farmers didn't need it. They didn't have a problem with weeds. They didn't need it at all. They didn't want it.
They don't have weeds? That's not a problem with wheat?
Well, correct. And it's because of the cycle generally of, you know, wheat harvest and wheat production. And the biggest problems were being experienced by northern wheat growers. And they didn't have weed problems so much as they had disease problems. Hmm. And Monsanto wanted to roll this out in the type of wheat that is grown in the northern states. And the northern state wheat growers said, no, we don't have weed problems, we have disease problems. Can you do something for us with disease? And Monsanto said, maybe later, but why don't you first accept this Roundup Ready?
First do this.
You know, wheat seed. Yeah. And international markets got very upset and said, we're not going to buy wheat from the United States if you introduce the genetically engineered wheat. And it became a very big sort of issue when farmers were very worried that they were going to lose important export markets. And they pushed back so hard that eventually Monsanto
gave in,
pulled back on that.
So what about other countries? Are Monsanto seeds found worldwide? Are they predominantly used in the United States, these Roundup Ready seeds?
So the genetically engineered seeds are in many, many different countries, are cultivated in many countries, but by far no one comes close to the amount of acreage or land mass planted to genetically engineered seeds. The United States is first, and then South America. And then there's a very precipitous drop-off in terms of, you know, the land mass that's devoted to genetically engineered crops. But there are, you know, many countries that have a very small amount planted to these crops.
And
not in Europe. Europe doesn't. Most of Europe does not allow the cultivation of genetically engineered crops.
Right, and any crops. I mean, there are some genetically engineered crops that are not Roundup Ready crops. Right, they're not necessarily you know, resistant.
Exactly. So. Roundup Ready, though, the glyphosate tolerance is the most predominant trait, and then after that, the next most popular, most predominant trait is an insect resistance. And that's a plant that, you know, is toxic, in essence, to the insects that are trying to chew on it.
Which makes it think that it would be toxic to us. But, you know, I'm not a scientist, so what do I know? That's a whole other issue. So how big of a business is this, you know, for Monsanto? Like, what were their profits like before, you know, let's say in the 90s, and then after these Roundup Ready seeds were introduced to the market?
Right. So Monsanto saw some pretty strong growth after the seeds came about. But, of course, they also went through a restructuring and they sold off some business. They spun off some. They had a whole line of industrial chemicals where they spun it off and filed for bankruptcy because there were massive litigation over these injuries due to these industrial chemicals. And so, you know, so the company's business bottom line really saw a lot of change about the time that it started focusing on these things. So it's not really, it wouldn't be an apples to apples to talk about '90s until modern day. But at the time that they were acquired by Bayer last summer, the company was had about $14 to $15 billion in revenue, and a good amount of that, about 20%, was singularly because of the pesticide part, the glyphosate business, and then the rest of that was mostly the seeds that are designed to be used with the Roundup. So.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, go on. So big business.
Big business. Very big business.
Do any of these big food companies, they basically all get their seeds from Monsanto, like, or 80% of them or so for the bigger commodity crops?
Monsanto licensed the trait. I mean, that was a big part of their business, is that they developed these genetically engineered traits that can be put into seeds, in essence, put into germplasm for different seeds. So different companies, you know, Pioneer DuPont or Dow or others, if they have great, you know, core seed germplasm, but they want that genetic trait, they could license it, in essence. They could pay Monsanto and use that trait.
Okay.
That glyphosate tolerant trait. So it, you know, it is found in seeds that are sold by a variety of companies.
Okay. All right. So what are some of the, you know, you talk a lot about, obviously, the safety, and we're going to get into some of the recent court cases in a little bit later that have, you know, said that this chemical is very unsafe and harmful to human health. But what were kind of some of the initial, you know, rumblings in terms of the concerns of safety, and what kind of evidence, how has the evidence sort of evolved?
Right. That's such a good question. I mean, for me as a journalist, the environmental problems became apparent first. Mm-hmm. You know, that and that the weed resistance and the soil health problems, we haven't gotten into that, but yeah, there was scientific research being done by USDA scientists that were showing that the soil, when exposed to glyphosate herbicides year after year after year, that it really was sterile is not the right word, but it was losing the micronutrients that are really so important and so needed for plant health. So the plants are becoming less nutritious and the soil is less robust and viable. So all of that, I was really kind of tracking that and following that and the use patterns and the competitiveness. But the scientific research pertaining to human health, you know, the more this was being used, of course, the more scientists were interested in tracking it and tracking right, what it might be doing. And so you started to see studies come up from around the world that were showing connections to carcinogenicity, to reproductive health concerns. So, you know, I started writing about those, and, you know, it was back in 2010, 2011, I think, when I said my first headline that said something about Roundup and cancer. And then, of course, we had the International Agency for Research on Cancer in 2015, which looked at all of these studies that had been done for so long. And these were not done by Monsanto. These were done by independent scientists, you know, at universities and public health agencies. And they said, yes, this looks like it is a probable human carcinogen with a particular association to non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
So let's go over, I want to talk about regulation because this is, I mean, I'm a pretty big fan of regulation, and certainly in instances like this where I would think that this kind of a substance would be heavily regulated, but I was constantly shocked to learn otherwise throughout, you know, throughout your entire book. So, like, what is the regulatory process just basically for bringing a new chemical like this to market in the United States?
Well, the companies will tell you it's particularly onerous and that they spend a lot of money to do the tests that the EPA requires and to file all of the papers and to go through all of the scrutiny. You know, and in fact, it is, you know, a long process. Now, a lot of these pesticides are allowed to go on the market without actually completing the process. That's a different story.
Yeah.
But, you know, one big problem, and there are many, is that in a pesticide, in a product like Roundup, for instance, the EPA only requires certain types of tests on the active ingredient. So they only ask for Monsanto to do tests on glyphosate, not on the combination that Monsanto was actually going to be selling to the public and that farmers were actually going to be spraying on our food. So, you know, they ran these tests on glyphosate. Now, glyphosate tests by themselves very early on showed trouble with the EPA in the 1980s. EPA scientists said these toxicology tests look like it causes cancer. The EPA doesn't do any of its own testing. They simply rely on the registrants. These are the companies that are selling the products. They rely on them to basically show them what the science is. And they rely very heavily on scientific studies that are funded and conducted by these companies.
Wow.
What we found, and people don't, you know, get that, I think. And what you see through the document trail, you know, I've obtained several thousand EPA documents, internal documents, archived documents. And what you see when you look at that and you look at their communications with Monsanto, you know, there are internal, you know, the scientists working at EPA who have real concerns. And then there are the politically appointed people and the managers and the superiors who are really working to keep Monsanto happy and working really closely with Monsanto and pushing back on their own scientists. So you see that, you know, throughout the history with this chemical. And, you know, it's gotten in some places to be, you know, at one point the Office of Inspector General said they were going to investigate collusion concerns between EPA and Monsanto. I mean, they're just evidence that, you know, lots and lots of evidence of very cozy relationships. And what one EPA, you know, scientist actually said in the memo, that our job is to protect public health. It's not to protect you.
Right. Monsanto. Well, I mean, one of the things you say is that actually the part of the mission of the EPA, and so is the EPA the only regulatory agency? I mean, the FDA and the USDA are involved in part, right? At certain points, or is it just the EPA?
So in terms of a pesticide, a chemical that you go out and you spray, like Roundup and glyphosate, that is primarily the EPA. Now, if you have a plant that is toxic to insects, that is regulated more by the USDA because it is a plant and all. And, of course, the FDA is involved in USDA in terms of the food and what sort of pesticide residues are we seeing in our food.
That's how they all work together.
The EPA is the one that Monsanto has to provide the test to and answer to.
So just to kind of summarize, the EPA is essentially testing this chemical in a vacuum and not in the way that it will actually be used in the real world.
Well, the EPA is doing no testing of the chemical.
What?
The EPA is reviewing the tests that are done by the company.
Okay. Even better.
Yeah. Probably not even.
Yeah, no, definitely not. So they are reviewing tests that are being done in a vacuum and are relying heavily on science that they don't do themselves, that is provided solely by the company.
That is mostly true. Yes, they do also look at, and you can see in their reports, that they also look at some outside independent studies.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done that with glyphosate. But when they see studies that show evidence of cancer, for instance, or something, a cancer connection, Monsanto is able to come back into them and explain to them why they should discount that and why they should ignore the findings of these independent studies. And you see that happen over and over and
the
over
EPA,
again.
Yeah. So it's like lobbying.
Even,
yeah.
Yes. The EPA at one point invited in several leading scientists from around the country to come and advise them on the way that they were assessing science as it pertains to Monsanto's product. And these scientists told them they were wrong and told them that they were doing it wrong and that they were not assessing the science correctly. And they just went ahead and maintained their position that it doesn't cause cancer. And they agree with Monsanto.
So you also write, this is what I started to say before, but you write about how the mission of the EPA is actually twofold. And part of it is to protect in the environment and environmental health, and the other part is to also protect industry in a way. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, and that's the USDA as well as the EPA. And the EPA, it's a little more nuanced. It's the language of what they're supposed to take into consideration. And it's not only health and safety issues and impact on the environment, impact on, you know, water and all of that, but also the economic impact they are supposed to take into consideration when, looking at whether or not to approve something or to restrict it. And that, you know, is troubling to a lot of people because, you know, why should a determination of safety have to do with economics, you know, and who's going to make money off of it? But what the EPA would say is that, you know, there are risks and rewards associated with almost everything. Almost every chemical, certainly, there are going to be risks and rewards. And so you have to balance all of these things. And if it's beneficial to farmers, it can help generate, you know, more money, more profits for farmers and for seed companies and chemical companies. And that helps the economy. You know, it's one side of the ledger that has to be weighed against the risk. But it is alarming to learn that is one factor that they have to look at.
So is there any testing? Well, we talked about the EPA. They rely on, you know, in terms of bringing the chemical to market. And then is there periodic follow-up testing with the safety of this chemical, or does that happen? Yeah, that's my first question.
So they're supposed to, every 15 years, do a re-registration sort of analysis and review. With Monsanto, it took a lot longer than that. I've lost track of, you know, how past 15 years we are now in terms of re-registration. But currently at this time, they are just completing a re-registration of this product. And Monsanto has, you know, they are agreeing with Monsanto that it's safe, that there shouldn't be, you know, restrictions put upon its use, that it shouldn't have new warning labels, it doesn't look like it causes cancer. So that's their position now. Now, we did get an interesting document last week recently here from a court file that had just been obtained by lawyers through discovery, and it's an internal Monsanto report that was generated by a corporate intelligence company that Monsanto hired to gauge the temperature of the Trump administration and see how helpful they were going to be to Monsanto. And what you see in this report, they're reporting back to Monsanto, and they say they've talked to, you know, a senior domestic policy advisor at the White House, and he told them, we have Monsanto's back on pesticide regulation. We're prepared to go toe-to-toe on any disputes they may have.
That's great.
And it goes on and on, you know, which a reading of this is quite long, is that, yes, the professional staffers within the regulatory agencies don't agree, but the political people in these regulatory agencies have Monsanto's back.
Well, that is really depressing. Okay, so
it's depressing.
It's really depressing. So what about in terms of like our food supply? So, you know, I think EPA, environmental health, what about like human health in terms of what we're ingesting? So USDA, FDA, how are traces, you know, how is like the prevalence of this chemical recorded and traced throughout our environment and food system?
This is my pet peeve and has been forever. And I think, frankly, it's the chapter in the book that makes most people just want to throw the book across the room. I don't know if it's in you. Chapter 4.
Yeah.
Where we talk about weed killer for breakfast.
Yeah.
I mean,
I have a lot of highlights on that chapter, by the way. It's very highlighted.
it's just infuriating. So food, you know, food and farming, conventional farmers use a lot of different insecticides and fungicides and herbicides, you know, in growing their food. And so we quite often in a lot of the food supply, there are traces of or residues of these different pesticides. And because we know they're dangerous and they can be harmful to human health, the EPA sets limits on the residue levels that can be in our food. And if it's higher than that limit, it's, you know, alarm bells are supposed to go off. And the FDA and USDA check thousands of food samples every year for these different pesticides. They've never wanted to test for glyphosate, even though glyphosate's the most widely used, even though it's been on the market for more than 40 years, even though we know it's sprayed directly onto many types of foods. They've never wanted to check for it. And that just drove me crazy every year when I would read their big fat reports, and they never had any testing for glyphosate.
I just don't, I almost don't believe it. I mean, I believe it because it's very well documented in your book, but I can't wrap my head around the fact that they're like, nope, we're going to pass on this.
Yep. And they would say to me, number one, it's really safe. So who cares?
We can't prove that, but
number two, they would say, it's probably not very much anyway. It's probably not very much in there anyway. Yeah. And they would say, it's really hard to test for it. It's different than other pesticides in the way it's distinct enough that you would have to run special tests on it.
Is that true?
That is true. And that's expensive and hard to do, and we don't want to do it. It's pretty much their answer. So
you think it'd be worth it, right? You think this is a big enough deal.
So what happened, right, is the Government Accountability Office issued a report in 2014 and said, you guys really need to test for this. You're not doing your job. You're not doing the public service. You need to test for this as part of your program. The FDA said, okay, we will. The USDA said, heck no, we are not going to. And they still are refusing to do that. Now, the FDA, the FDA gave a green light to its senior chemist to start doing, you know, putting together a testing program for glyphosate. One of their very most senior chemists pulled some honey samples and oatmeal and things like that and started doing some testing and found, and I have all of this laid out in through Freedom of Information documents. The FDA has never discussed this really publicly, but this chemist found very high levels of glyphosate, levels that would be considered illegal in honey samples, and reported that to his supervisors, and they told him not to worry about it, and nothing he needed to concern himself with. He then did the same thing with oatmeal, found very high levels in baby food oatmeal products on store shelves. And, he was very alarmed by all of this and trying to report this. And what happened is he got reassigned and was told he could no longer do any pesticide testing on food.
Wow. I mean, how does it end up in honey? Like, that doesn't necessarily, that would not be the first thing that I would think about, you know, where I would think to look for this chemical. And yet it seems, I mean, you just said the levels were through the roof.
Right. And well, it's because bees go wherever bees want to go. And bees, are exposed to pesticides and glyphosate, particularly around farm fields where it's been sprayed on crops, you know, or it's been sprayed in you know, any variety of areas where bees would go, and they pick it up and it comes back, and then it becomes part of their honey. And then it becomes part of your breakfast on toast.
Right. Yeah.
So, and consumer groups have now become very concerned, and they've started doing an array of testing on cereals and snacks and bread products and, essentially are documenting this chemical in a whole array of commonly consumed foods. And the other notable thing about that is, you know, our government in Monsanto continues to say, okay, we've documented it in foods, but you know what? It's within the legal limits, so don't worry about it. It's largely, not everything. There are a lot of things that are really, at very high levels, but it's within the legal limits, so don't worry about it.
How do they set that?
Right, but what they don't say is, and oh, by the way, we've raised that level over and over and over again because Monsanto keeps asking us to raise the legal limits, to make it so that higher levels of these residues are legally allowed in our food. And, that's
a problem.
Story that many consumers aren't aware of, right? And, you know if you're spraying Roundup, you do that voluntarily. You don't know if you're eating it. And that's a problem for a lot of people.
So this lead chemist was reassigned. Where does that, research stand now?
So they've had quite a fit of starts and stops, and they started the program, they suspended him, they reassigned him, they suspended the program, they restarted the program, they've had more problems, and it's supposedly still ongoing, but we haven't gotten any really robust data from the FDA.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about, while we're on the subject of this idea that you can just reassign a leading chemist, and that, it seems like the company was working to discredit, his work and also just the scientists who didn't, whose findings were in opposition to what they would hope for. I'm wondering if you yourself experience any kind of pushback or backlash from a company and, taking on an issue of this magnitude.
I've experienced incredible backlash. I don't even call it backlash anymore. I call it harassment, intimidation, efforts to discredit me, efforts to discredit my book. Monsanto orchestrated numerous attacks on my character. I lay out one incident in the book when I was at Reuters. Monsanto funded a startup organization called Academics Review, which is a web-based supposed scientific analysis organization. It doesn't disclose itself as being set up and funded by Monsanto. It presents itself as an independent, authentic voice on science. And this Academics Review organization, you know, wrote multiple scathing pieces about me that were put up on the internet and shared and that sort of thing. And, you know, we know Monsanto funded it, and we know Monsanto set it up because we have the internal emails in which Monsanto is saying, we're going to set this up. We want to keep Monsanto in the background so it won't Wow. affect the credibility of the information. We have some targets for you to go after. So they've written, you know, about me, other journalists, other scientists. And there are multiple organizations like this that have been set up. We have another one called the American Council on Science and Health. Sounds really, you know,
professional,
professional and trustworthy. Yeah. We have internal emails where they are saying, hey, you know, we need some more money. Look at all we've done for you. You know, look at all that we're doing to promote the safety of your chemical and to criticize, you know, these people who are, you know, reporting and things. Please send us more money. And you have Monsanto saying, sure, we're sending you more money. I mean, it's
crazy. That's crazy.
It's brilliant, really, on Monsanto's part. And they talk a great deal in their internal emails about the importance of using third parties, because they don't think that people will find the information credible if it comes from Monsanto. Mm-hmm. So, but they think if there are third parties that look like they're independent, and Monsanto can secretly send them the messages or secretly ghostwrite articles for them or secretly send them money, and then they can present the message, it will be much more compelling. And that's what they've been doing for decades. And it's not opinion, it's not speculation, it's laid out in emails, communications, strategy reports, very clear.
So it seems to be that there's been a bit of a shift, changing of the winds for Monsanto. So they were recently purchased by Bayer. When was that? It was like a year ago or so?
The deal closed last June. Yeah, June of 2018.
And what was it? And remind me the number. It was a big one.
They paid Bayer, the German company, paid about $63 billion for Monsanto.
And now I think they might be having some buyer's remorse. Do you want to tell us a little bit about, there have been a few court cases recently that have been pretty major blows to the company. Can you tell us a little bit, certainly about the most recent one that really the verdict was just handed down? Was it this week? I think it was this week.
Yeah, so what has happened is after the International Agency for Research on Cancer declaration that this is a probable carcinogen, you started to see law firms around the country signing up plaintiffs who have developed non-Hodgkin lymphoma, which was the type of cancer that, you know, was linked specifically to exposure to Roundup and other Monsanto products. And you now have about 13,400 or so plaintiffs around the United States. And we've had three trials. And as you mentioned, the most recent trial concluded just here in early May. And the jury awarded $2 billion in punitive damages to a husband and wife who used Roundup for about 30 years and both have non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
I mean, that is a stunning amount.
It's quite stunning. Yeah. And it was meant by the jurors and asked for by the plaintiff's attorneys to send a message to Bayer, to send a message to Monsanto that they should start warning people, that they should acknowledge the risks and compensate people and put warning labels on so that people know maybe they should wear protective gear. Maybe, you know, maybe farmers shouldn't spray it directly onto foods and things, that we need to look at the risks as well as the rewards. And, you know, so, I mean, obviously Bayer is appealing. There have been three trials. They've lost three trials. The first verdict was $289 million to a school groundskeeper who's dying of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. The second one was $80 million. To a man, California man, who has non-Hodgkin lymphoma, but is largely in remission. And then this one, This one was $55 million in compensatory damages and $2 billion in punitive, which, you know, is just crazy. No one expects that punitive damage award really to stand at $2
billion. Right, right.
A judge is very likely to lower that, but it still is a pretty powerful message. And what has happened, of course, is that the Bayer share price, the valuation of the company, has plummeted.
Yeah, definitely didn't rise, that's for sure.
Since the first verdict came out on August 10th of 2018, they've lost about 40% of their value.
Wow.
The shareholders are furious. They have called for the firing of the CEO who orchestrated the acquisition. There's all sorts of uproar in Europe over why Bayer would do this, why they would purchase this company with such liability.
I mean, I think that's what everybody's asking, but do you have any idea? I mean, I cannot imagine a world where a company spends, acquires another for $60+ billion and they did not take into account the fact that, I mean, these court cases, some of them had been ongoing, right? And this is not, the company has a long history of litigation against it for a variety of grievances. So I can't imagine they didn't know that this was coming, but maybe I'm wrong.
If they did know, they did a terrible job of communicating it to shareholders because it certainly caught shareholders by surprise. You know, and in the world of publicly traded companies, that's a giant no-no. You should never surprise your shareholders with bad news. and that clearly is what's happened. Now, the lawsuit started, they started in 2015. They expanded in 2016, 2017. The deal didn't close until 2018, so you could argue that Bayer had ample time to become aware of the risks. They say they believe Monsanto's long-held position that there is no valid scientific evidence associating this chemical with cancer and that Monsanto was not deceptive in its practices. Now, that tune is changing just a little bit in the last few days. Bayer is starting to acknowledge that, Monsanto really hasn't been the best corporate citizen, maybe, and maybe there are some problems, but it's still really, really safe.
Okay, we're going to take a really quick break right now to hear a word from our sponsors, but when we get back, we will continue our conversation with Carrie Gillum, author of Whitewash.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Maker's first-of-its-kind virtual agritourism conference. Did you know that every $1 invested in tourism marketing returns on average $3 to $8 back? Not a bad ROI. Learn how to grow your agritourism business via 12 workshops entirely women-led. The local travel landscape is rapidly changing to meet the demands of the leisure, event, and corporate travel sectors. Whether you're a farmer or producer, a winemaker, a restaurateur, or a destination marketing organization, there's more opportunity than ever to capture these markets. The Virtual Agritourism Conference will provide you with insights and skills to keep your target demographic coming back for more. 14 speakers providing 6+ hours of education that you can watch at your convenience anytime on any device. Maximize your time, budget, and resources, and focus on creative solutions to help your business thrive. Presented by Escape Maker and Fulton Stall Market, the full conference access pass is now available for purchase. Use the code HERITAGE2019 for $50 off a full pass at checkout. For more information and to purchase your pass, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And you know, Heritage Radio Network has thousands more. Hi, my name is Linda Pelagio, and I'm the host on A Taste of the Past here on HRN. Join us on a weekly journey through culinary history, where we explore the when, where, what, and why of food throughout history. You can find A Taste of the Past wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're talking all about glyphosate with investigative journalist and author Carrie Gillum. Can you just break down really quickly the different classifications that there are for gauging the safety of a chemical, both domestically and in the international community? Because as far as I understand it, there are some differences between how certain agencies, you know, what certain agencies think about glyphosate.
Well, certainly. I mean, the regulatory agencies really around the world, regardless of what they call it, are largely in agreement that it doesn't look likely that this causes cancer. That's in essence what the EPA says, that it's not likely to be carcinogenic. So they're not saying definitely not, but more likely than, you know, it's not. Now, within the EPA, now that is the Office of Pesticide Programs that has responsibility really for the regulation of pesticides, that has said that in their risk assessment. The scientific arm of the EPA, the Office of Research and Development, disagrees with that. And they were consulted by the Office of Pesticide Programs, and they were told that they thought that there was evidence that it does cause cancer. This is, again, these are the scientists in EPA who said, you're wrong. To say it's not likely is just not following the science. And that's, you know, documented again in memos from the Office of Research and Development in the EPA. But the EPA public position is, we say it's not likely to cause cancer.
Well, what about...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, but what about the WHO? Because they have a different take on it, don't they? That was recently...
Right. So the World Health Organization, what they do, they have an arm called the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And we talked about that group earlier. That is an arm that exists to look at substances that people are exposed to determine if they have a cancer causation, you know, connection. And so they don't just look at pesticides. They look at a whole array of different things, you know, a type of food or coffee or something like that that people would be exposed to. And it's a hazard classification. So they're not looking at exactly how much a person is taking in. They're looking at, can this substance cause cancer? You know, can it do that? And what they determined with glyphosate, and they don't do their own studies. Again, they look at published peer-reviewed studies done by scientists around the world. And the people who look at these are the elite cancer scientists. They're people who have nothing to do with industry. They don't have anything to do with special interest groups. You know, the leader of the glyphosate working group spent most of his career with the National Cancer Institute. They're epidemiologists and toxicology experts. And they looked at this as a very apolitical body with no political agenda, and said the weight of science shows us it is a probable human carcinogen. They didn't say a definite one. They could have, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. But in terms of regulatory bodies in the United States and in Europe and Canada and elsewhere, they have all, you know, basically said, we agree with Monsanto. And again, they don't do their own tests. They rely pretty heavily on the tests that are done by Monsanto. And that's a big difference, because tests that are done by Monsanto or other chemical companies are typically not published. They're not peer-reviewed. Some people refer to them as secret studies. So they're not open for scrutiny as to whether or not they've been done well, if they've been done according to scientific principles. They're secret. So the World Health Organization's group doesn't give much weight to these so-called secret studies. They look at ones that are out there, that are published, that are reviewed by other scientists, and are held to certain specific standards of scientific integrity.
So what does this mean for the consumer, right? If I'm going to, like, a key takeaway for me would be, probably causes cancer. Like, yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think that it seems like the WHO has not anything really, or not as much at stake, like, politically, right? They're just strictly looking at the science versus regulatory agencies throughout the world, which clearly have other competing interests to some degree.
Well, Right. I mean, the regulatory agencies, like in the United States, our EPA is run by a political appointee. You know, it's about the politics. It's about the money. It's support, you know, and the companies spend a lot of money in Washington to lobby and to get the people they want in positions of authority, specifically for these reasons. Monsanto called it internally freedom to operate, FTO, freedom to operate. They wanted to do everything they could to protect their freedom to operate. And that included ghostwriting studies that would appear in the published peer-reviewed literature. So they would look like they were, you know, these highly regarded. And I mean, we also saw them paying, you know, money to editors of some of these scientific journals, spreading money throughout the academic research population in the United States. So there's a lot of reasons to be concerned about the regulatory, you know, category. And the biggest one to me is, again, it isn't glyphosate. No one out there is just exposed to glyphosate. We're exposed to the formulations. And in Europe, one of the key ingredients that Monsanto's been using in its formulations has been banned because it's so dangerous. So a key takeaway for consumers, I guess, if you love your Roundup and you really want to use it, wear gloves, wear long pants, wear
just
a breathing mask.
Yeah, just don't do it. Just don't use it.
The evidence that even Monsanto's own internal analysis shows that this stuff gets soaked up into the skin. It goes into your bloodstream. It can even go through clothing if your clothing is damp, if you're sweating. It's a very powerful, very potent chemical that is not safe enough to drink.
Not safe to drink. Just to give us a point of like a reference, the WHO's classification. So is there an example of a substance that they say, like, what definitely causes cancer? What are they kind of like unanimous on in terms of like the next categorization?
Well, I would have to go back and look that up. You know, surprisingly, there are not that many. I mean, they've found that most of their substances that they look at actually are either possibly carcinogenic, which is a lower rung, or not determined to be carcinogenic. Right. There's not enough science to determine it. So, you know, one of the criticisms that the chemical industry continues to put out there is, oh, IARC finds everything is cancerous. You know, they find everything is. I mean, if you actually look at their data, they've looked at a little bit over 1,000 different substances, and only, you know, a small percentage of those have they determined is actually carcinogenic. So,
okay, I don't have a garden anymore, unfortunately, and even if I did, I certainly never sprayed it with Roundup. I don't want to be exposed to this. So what can I do to protect myself? Like I don't use it. So like, is there anything else I can do, to kind of get myself as far away from this, chemical or combination of chemicals as possible?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can eat organic. It's not allowed in organic production. That's a little bit of a flawed notion because our U.S. Geological Survey, which is part of the Department of Interior, has documented glyphosate in rainfall. So rain falls where rain falls, and that could be on an organic field, of course. Mm-hmm. Glyphosate is ubiquitous. It's found not only in rainfall, it's found in air samples, it's found in soil samples, it's found in human urine. It's pretty hard to get away from.
Yeah.
But if you want to try, you know, you want to eat organic, you don't want to use it in your yard, you want to probably, what a lot of people have been doing is talking to city councils and parks, you know, people who, public officials who have the power to restrict the use of this pesticide in public parks where our kids play and in school grounds and things like that.
Yeah, that was one thing that, you know, and that you said early on in the book about, which I kind of didn't think about initially. I kind of went straight to like, you know, it's used for agricultural purposes, but you talk about, especially in the early days, like cities and municipalities using it, you know, to spray along the roadside for weeds, or, you know, on golf courses, for instance, or just like all these other kind of applications that you wouldn't necessarily think of, and certainly in parks and all kinds of public spaces. So, okay, so
exactly. And if you think about it, if you're out there, you know, if your children are out in a park and they're rolling around throwing a football and, you know, getting dirty, and, you know, they're being exposed if it's been sprayed there.
What can we do? So besides, you know, eating in a certain way and not spraying your yard with harmful chemicals, what are some of the other kind of bigger, you know, policy interventions or solutions that you would like to see happen in order to reduce or to try to start to reduce the, you know, the amount to which we are all exposed?
Well, when you talk to farmers, as I do quite often, and you know, people who are concerned about the soil and water quality, which, you know, is a very, very big problem related to agriculture and not only glyphosate but other pesticides and fertilizers and livestock operations, they say we really need a paradigm shift. We spent the last 40 or so years, or, you know, focused on chemical agriculture, using pesticides, fungicides, insecticides to beat Mother Nature into submission and grow the crops we want, where we want, how we want. But Mother Nature is basically fighting back and saying, yeah, that's not working out so well for you now, right? So there are farmers around the country, around the world, but here in the United States, who are experimenting, doing things differently in their fields. There's, of course, organic operations, but farmers who are separately, not necessarily trying to be organic, but trying to be much more judicious in their use if they are going to use pesticides, and they're finding they can reduce them if they use cover crops, if they rotate their fields, if they shake up their row spacing, if they encourage more biodiversity around their fields. And they're getting a little bit of grant money, but not a lot. And I think, you know, when you talk to people, they say we need our government to support the long-term solutions for environmental and public health, and that doesn't involve pesticides. So we're giving a lot of money to corn growers in subsidies, for instance. Well, that helps the chemical companies and the companies that are selling the corn seed. We don't need more corn. We have 1 billion bushels of corn every year that we can't sell, that we can't use, that we can't get rid of, that just sits in storage. We don't need to be subsidizing corn growers. We need to be subsidizing farmers who are looking for long-term solutions. So, you know, that's something we talk about. There are many different things people are working on. It's a hard hill to climb because you have a lot of, you know, corporate money and corporate power resisting a paradigm change.
Right. And also a political administration that is very much does not seem likely to support some of these changes to industry. And, you know, you talk about the regulation, that there needs to be like a really big change in how these substances are monitored and regulated.
Yes, I mean, people talk about, you know, can we do more independent testing? Can we fund more independent testing? Can we test for the formulated products as opposed to just the active ingredients? And to their credit, the EPA did finally say in 2016, okay, I guess we do need to start testing the formulated products. And they are working with the National Toxicology Program right now to do that.
Good.
You know,
it's a start.
Unfortunately, it took 40-some years since these products have been on the market to do that toxicity testing. They have found in the first results that have come back that, yes, the formulated products are, you know, quite much more potent and toxic than is glyphosate by itself, and they do kill human cells.
I shouldn't be laughing. It's not funny. It's devastating, but it's almost comical. Like, I mean, that's a low bar, right? But I guess we have to support any kind of movement in the right direction.
Yeah, and it's nuanced. It's not the government against the people. You know, there are really good scientists inside our agencies, inside the National Institutes of Health.
Absolutely.
And National Toxicology Program, who are trying their very best.
Yeah.
There's a woman named Linda Birnbaum, who heads up our NIEHS, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And she's been warning. She's been writing papers and speaking out and saying our regulatory agencies are not keeping up with the science. They're not protecting the public. And, you know, what we've seen so far is lawmakers going after her head and trying to get her kicked out of her job. But, you know, people need to pay attention and, you know, support policies that protect the public and not corporate profits.
Yeah, and definitely, it is heartening to hear that there are people in these agencies, you know, really trying to do the right thing. And we would hate to kind of overgeneralize, you know, and just say that they're, you know, like, you know, paint everybody with the same broad brush. But, you know, and at the same time, it is, I think, as the public, our expectations can be higher for being protected.
Yeah. I mean, what I see is, you know, we have an election coming up. You know, you have midterms, and people talk about foreign policy, right? And environmental policy and all these things. People rarely talk about food policy.
I know.
And food policy impacts every one of us probably much more than anything else.
Yep.
Right? We all eat every day and we feed our children every day. And what could be more important than the health of, and the sustainability of our food? And we've been letting, you know, these corporations direct the policy, and it's not going in the right direction.
What is next for you?
I'm working on another book. I'm doing this research for this nonprofit group, U.S. Right to Know Now, and we, you know, filed Freedom of Information Act requests with our government agencies and universities, and try to bring information to light about all of these matters, about food policy, and not just agriculture and pesticide, but also looking at, you know, additives and sweeteners and things like that. There's a whole lot to know about the food that we eat.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so any preview of what your book is going to be about, or is that top secret for now?
Oh, we should probably keep it top secret.
All right. Well, I would love an interview with you once it is released.
Thank you.
Oh, great. Okay. So, and then finally, where can our listeners go to read more of your work and to kind of be, you know, to be kept in the loop about what you're doing?
Well, I have lots and lots of articles and different presentations and interviews like this one on my website, carriegillum.com. And you can always go to usrtk.org, where we compile a lot of the documents that I've talked about today and present news and information for people who are interested. That's U.S. Right to Know, usrtk.org. And you can always follow me on Twitter, at Carrie Gillum. I tweet a lot. And I like to tweet documents.
Oh, nice.
I like to tweet just copies of documents and links to data and things like that. I'm not much for my own public opinion out there. I just like to share news as I get it.
So. Yes. Well, that's very important, especially in today's day and age. Facts first. Okay. Carrie, thank you so much for coming on the show and chatting with us about this. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as to our engineer, Amanda Wang. Show music is by Tim Archer. All of our episodes are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liu, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrations happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.